Welcome back to another episode of the Occasionalists. Matt Pagel here, once again, kicking things off with our fourth week of the Occasionalist Daily Podcast. So far, so good. We have hit every single episode. Every single day has had a new episode, which is great. And we are continuing with that drive here this week as we get into this week's a little bit more of a trying to stay a little bit more topical in terms of like what's happening in the world. We're going to, you know, try to stay on top of some new trends. Shouldn't say new trends, but news or, you know, stuff that is trending in the news. So we're going to try to stay a little bit more topical than usual. Not that we were not topical in previous episodes of the Daily Podcast, but as you would call it for, you know, if you're programming a radio station, or obviously more like a TV station. But if you're programming a radio TV station, you have programming on that you just call evergreen. In other words, it can just kind of run whenever. It doesn't matter. It's timeless. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, it's just not tied to anything in particular. But what we're going to be trying to do this week is actually tie ourselves to things that have happened recently. So I don't know, like current events week, I suppose this is kind of what you could call it, except for the last episode on Friday, which will be like a month in review kind of deal. But otherwise we're definitely going to be keeping up. And I will say this, we're not going to be like, it's not going to be spot on every day, like something that happened, you know, something that happened on Monday, we're not necessarily going to talk about it on Tuesday, but this is more recent current events that we are going to be talking about. So for today's episode, Monday, March 25th, we're going to be talking about gambling. And I think I'm also going to structure these episodes. I'm going to give like a little bit of a history lesson before getting into actually what is, you know, the crux of like what I want to talk about. So there's going to be a brief history lesson, maybe like 4 or 5 minutes or so, before we get into kind of what really makes me interested in any particular topic this week. And obviously, like I said, we are kicking this week off by talking about gambling. And no on this day kind of stuff. I think it definitely worked, I think, really, really well for the music playlist last week. But because we are kind of getting, like I said, trying to be a little bit more current events and a little bit more topical with things going on in the world this week, it doesn't really matter if we do an on this day kind of thing. So that's it. We're putting that in the past, and we are instead going to go ahead and just kind of, like I said, give a little history lesson before we jump into the main topic. All right, as I mentioned, as you probably should be fully well aware at this point, we're going to be discussing gambling. So I think it's important to kind of round back and give you a brief history of gambling in the United States. And I will say this is a very brief history. Just a few points that really kind of stood out to me as being kind of critically important or just, you know, very generally kind of interesting. You know, there's, if you really, really want to get into a history of gambling in the U.S., you know, there's like some Wikipedia pages you can start with. There are plenty of books that detail the rise of criminal Las Vegas. There are plenty of books that cover that cover the widespread illegal gambling in New York. There's plenty of places to look, but we are just going to kind of give you a 30,000 foot view of some important moments that kind of lead up to what I want to talk about. So we got to go all the way back to the beginning, quite literally back to the beginning, right? We got to go back to Virginia in the 1680s. The upper class were already, let me reset this real quick. So Virginia, 1680s, people from the colonists had brought with them, certain types of number games and other card games and little games of chance with them, obviously, you know, gambling and betting and, you know, that kind of stuff has its roots literally going back to like Mesopotamia, right? Like there are various games, like I think backgammon is a game that is like 2000 years old or something like that. So like these games of chance have just been with us forever. But for the United States, you know, certain little card games and things and an interest in racing and stuff like that comes over with the colonists. And this is especially prevalent among the upper class, and this is why this is very important here. So by the 1680s in Virginia, the upper class were already sort of figuring out how to create rules and codes of conduct around gambling, be it their interest in horse racing, or be it their interest in card gaming and numbers gaming. The upper class were already sort of kind of setting up house rules and things like that. There were certain codes of conduct on, literally on how you could dress, for a gambling event, be it like a horse race. More than likely the big ones were horse races. But how you could dress for like a table gaming, kind of evening, the amounts you could bet, the minimum amounts you could bet. And they were creating these codes of conduct literally to separate themselves for the uber wealthy, to really separate themselves from the other, landowners who maybe were, even though it didn't really quite exist yet, but other landowners who probably would be otherwise considered middle class. And certainly they were separating themselves even farther from the lower class, from the working class. So this was like sort of an attempt to really sort of draw a line and kind of frame the wealthy were kind of trying to frame their gambling habits as being kind of more civilized, since there were like standards to them. Whereas what the other people, the working class and the poor class were doing, they're gambling on cards and whatever else, since it was less standardized and had less sort of regulations and rules around it, it was kind of seen as like low class or uncivilized. And this is just a way to sort of, wherever there is gambling, the poor always get sort of blamed for the ills of gambling, right? Like, we know that gambling brings a lot of, we know that gambling brings a lot of negative things along with it. And very often, despite the poor not necessarily being the ones who can most fully participate in it, they do get blamed for a lot of the ills that gambling brings along with it. So just kind of an important note there, that this literally goes back to the very founding of the United States. Both gambling and gambling, regulating and standardizing gambling for the benefit of the upper class, and then blaming poor people for any ills that might come from gambling. Literally, we're talking about the founding of the United States. So just kind of an interesting note there. In fact, you can go back to going back to this same time period and moving forward. There were these things called, obviously we still have them, but there were these colonial lotteries. And they were really, what they were really were around for were to help fund the various colonies. Keeping in mind that these were business ventures, right? Like that the original colonies weren't just, it wasn't just people who were like dissatisfied. I mean, there were obviously people who were dissatisfied and wanted to move, but it was, this was a very, the Massachusetts Bay Company, right? Like I can't remember what Virginia was called, Virginia Virginia Trading Company or whatever, right? Like they gave these territories company names because these were companies. So it is, it is kind of important to note that that these state lotteries, or these colonial lotteries existed way back before there were even states. In fact, there's at least evidence of 392 different lotteries in the 13 colonies that they could find in, that researchers could find in various newspapers. So the idea of gambling came right over with people as they left Europe, and they just brought it in and brought it here to the United States and kind of figured out a way to regulate it and standardize it, basically. Okay, so and again, I'm not really surprised by this, right? Again, just the colonies were a business venture, and they needed money to continue, and simply having any kind of economic setup where we have the uber wealthy versus the people doing all the work for the uber wealthy, it's not surprising that it's not surprising that we're getting this sort of standardization of standardization of another source of revenue, right? Like, it just doesn't surprise me. All of these things kind of working together, these, you know, these kind of conditions, I suppose, working together to make this possible. And it really isn't, and it's kind of interesting, like, this kind of just goes on for quite a while, many, many decades. Really have to get, like, more, like, into the 1730s, 1740s or so, before there's any real resistance to gambling, because, like, there were certain people who were not interested in gambling already, or, like, maybe even saw it as a as a negative, as a societal negative. But it really doesn't start to get any kind of pushback until there are more widespread religious movements. Again, in the early to mid 1700s is when you begin having these religious movements, and then you begin having a little bit more sort of open protest against gambling in all of its forms, be it horse racing or table gaming, numbers gaming, that kind of stuff. It takes a while before anyone really pushes back on it. So, you know, the upper class in Virginia get a nice about 50 years of unfettered gambling in before there begins to pushback and questioning of the morality and legality of gambling. Now, I had to highlight this for you because I find this just very fascinating, kind of mind-blowing, actually. But for a long time, there was a very robust ecosystem, presidential election betting ecosystem throughout the United States. So much so that, it was technically illegal, but some of these, there were people that would kind of, before the advent of polling, there were people who were reporting on presidential elections and all things politics that would kind of, they would pay attention to where the betting action was on a certain president, on a certain presidential candidate, or candidates for other offices too, but presidential election betting was the big one, but there were other election betting schemes as well. And it was, you know, they were, I wouldn't say they're fairly accurate, but they're more, the betting action was more accurate than you would think for predicting an eventual presidential winner. So this was a real thing from the 1870s through about 1940. All of this was illegal, but none of it was, there wasn't like the exact, there wasn't exactly a fully formed codes of conduct and actual laws outlawing certain things. But the spirit of gambling and basically the bare bones of gambling have been illegal in the United States for quite a long time. But certain things just weren't in the... I don't want to get too many details here. Let's stick this to the presidential election betting. So from the 1870s to 1940, there was a lot of illegal betting centered on the presidential elections. Spending for these election bets often exceeded Wall Street money, the amount being traded on Wall Street in any given presidential election year could actually exceed what was going to be spent on Wall Street. The reason why it curtails again, there were a lot of things finally put on, you know, laws put to paper, essentially, that helped outlaw certain aspects of gambling were outlawed, like, officially, even though they were kind of under certain, like, laws. It was just sort of blanket understood that certain things were illegal, but now certain things were becoming specifically illegal. So that kind of knocks down the amount of presidential election betting over the decades. And then around 1940 is when, really actually 1930s, but 1940 is when Gallup, the polling company, accurately predicts the presidential election that year. And it kind of comes to the realization that polling is much more accurate to determine who, determine political office and things like that. So, just the kind of combination of law changes and like a more scientific method of determining who might be voting for who really kind of helps quell the election betting. And quite frankly, considering where we are now with our elections and the divisiveness of our political divisiveness, it is a good thing that we cannot bet on the president, because I think that would just be another thing to make people nastier about their political choices. I just don't think if that had continued, I think America would be in a far worse spot, at least in the discourse, at least in the political discourse, than where we are now. And where we are now is obviously not a good place. All right, we're going to jump to Nevada, 1931, and we're going to talk briefly about Assembly Bill 98. Nevada was in fairly dire economic straits in the 1930s, 1920s and 1930s. You know, it's already a small, I mean, it's a big state physically, but in terms of its population, even now it's a fairly small state. It was a much smaller state back in the 1920s and 1930s, and, you know, only had a few real population centers. Not much in the way of, if you've been to Nevada, it's not like it's a great place to go grow things, right? Like your economic revenue as a state is very limited in Nevada, especially at this point in time. Obviously, it's quite a bit different now, and that's because of Assembly Bill 98. Assembly Bill 98 legalized most forms of gambling in the state of Nevada in 1931. So that was their whole point, was like, okay, well, we have some of these things. We already have some of these casinos and these kind of entertainment revenues, venues. So why not try to make these, the revenue off these? But it really would take about a decade, before interest in gambling in Nevada picked up. It really wasn't until they really didn't begin to turn profits, big profits. Obviously when organized crime shows up to town, but more importantly, other states nearby and other major metropolitan areas on the West Coast all crack down on gambling, be it illegal or otherwise. It gets declared illegal all across the United States, right? Around this point in time, but even then, certain states had before a full federal, federal law outlawing gambling, except for in Nevada, of course, other states had already begun cracking down. And this sort of just instantly makes Las Vegas into the hotspot, the resort place to go, because now they can, people from California, people from Arizona, people from Texas, wherever, can make the trip now. Colorado, obviously, can make the trip now. And lose some of their money in Las Vegas. And, Las Vegas booms in the 1940s and 1950s because of all the crackdowns in the surrounding states and major metropolitan areas. And obviously, again, the influx of mob money and, mob backing of casinos and things really makes things jump off like crazy in Las Vegas at this point in time. But the good old days, of Bugsy Siegel and the mob running Vegas don't last as long as you would think. Certainly it extends for, I guess, really into like the 80s and 90s. But it really kind of, once there is money to be made, that's when the uber rich began to descend upon Vegas and began buying up and investing in real estate, buying casinos, buying hotels. And, among them, like Howard Hughes is one of the first initial big money, in today's money, he'd be a billionaire. I don't think he was a billionaire back then. I don't think there were any billionaires back then, or like maybe there's one. But like Howard Hughes and the sort of captains of industry of this time, those were the ones who, after the mob kind of set everything up and started making money, then you had more legitimate business partners come in and buy the hotels and casinos and things. And obviously, it takes a while for all of that to get bought up. But thinking about Vegas now is one of the resort destinations in the United States, and I've been to Vegas plenty of times. It just, nothing could seem more polished and commercial and corporate in terms of a resort town than Vegas. Certainly would have been an interesting place to see back when the mob was running it. That's for sure. All right, now we're gonna get into finally gonna get into the our kind of our segue into the main topic here. The Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992. This states, this is a countrywide, this is a federal law that states that every state cannot legalize sports gambling except for horse racing, dog racing, and for some fucking reason, Hi-Li. If you're unfamiliar with what Hi-Li is, and it's J-A-I, A-L-A-I, it's like a Spanish sport, with like these like scoop, you gotta like wear heavy padding and like you have like this like scoop handle thing that you fling a ball with. I don't know why this was exempt from the PASPA of 1992. I have zero idea. But 1992 is when we established that. There is no sports gambling except for, again, horse racing, dog racing, and Hi-Li. You know, and obviously Nevada is exempt from this as well. You know, there's, so 1992, Nevada becomes the only place in which you could walk into a casino, walk into a sports book, and, you know, place a bet on your favorite team to win the World Series or cover a spread that night. So we get a solid 26 years of the PASPA before it is overturned by the Supreme Court in 2018, and this opens the door for widespread sports gambling. Delaware, our first state, appropriately becomes the first state to legalize sports gambling statewide through their casinos. They have like three casinos in Delaware, which doesn't seem like a lot, but when you remember that Delaware is about the size of Elon Musk's house, three casinos is plenty, right? So Delaware, the first state, is the first state to make sports gambling legal statewide, and obviously just state after state from that point in time then follows. I'm in Ohio. It wasn't until 2021. I feel like it was like right after the pandemic. Yeah, I think it was like right after the pandemic. Sports gambling became legal in Ohio finally. And there are still some holdouts, which we will talk about here in a little bit as we get into our main subject that is covering sports gambling. And a kind of a very, at the very least, an ugly situation, and at the potentially a truly terrible situation for Major League Baseball is kind of on just in the early stages right now. Okay, so let's get into the topic of the day, as it has to do with gambling, in particular sports gambling, and it has to do with baseball's biggest star and his interpreter. We are talking about Shohei Ohtani and Ipe Mizuhara. If you are not a sports fan, you probably still know who, at least tangentially, who Shohei Ohtani is, or maybe you've heard the name. If you are a sports fan, you know that that Shohei Ohtani is maybe the most, outside of like a few NBA players, maybe the most popular athlete on the planet. You know, the Japanese sensation who the two-way, although he'll just be hitting this year, but two-way sensation who's a two-time unanimous MVP. Pitches one of the best pitchers in the league, also happens to be one of the best hitters in the league. truly haven't seen anything like him before. You might be less familiar, even if you are a sports fan, you might be less familiar with Ipe Mizuhara, who is his interpreter. He's been his interpreter since he came over to the United States. I think actually he was his interpreter in Japan, I think, prior to coming to the United States as well. So these two have been, you know, I guess joined at the hip, if you will. If you've watched like the World Baseball Classic or All Star Games or anything else like that, you have seen Ipe Mizuhara in the dugout talking to Ohtani, or you know, doing interviews with Ohtani. You have seen this guy for sure. So what happened with Ohtani and Mizuhara? So Ipe Mizuhara was fired. Let me backtrack real quickly here. The Dodgers and the Padres kicked off the regular season. It's the official, the unofficial start to the regular season. They played two regular season games in Seoul, South Korea. You know, if you weren't up at like 7 in the morning, you probably weren't watching these games, or you know, whatever it happens. But they kicked off the almost coughed out loud there. but they kicked off these games in Seoul, South Korea. They kicked off the season in Seoul, South Korea with a pair of games. And in between, I think it was in between the first and the second game, or maybe it was, yeah, maybe it was right after the first game, whatever. News came out that Ipe Mizuhara was being fired by the Dodgers, and he was under investigation by the IRS for accruing gambling debts and making payments to an illegal bookmaker in California. This is humongous news, especially in baseball, which I'll get into more detail here. Gambling and baseball just have a sordid history. But this was enormous news because there were, because of this kind of the sudden nature of it, but ESPN and I can't remember who else, possibly the AP, had been working on these stories for quite a while, that they knew about Ipe Mizuhara's involvement with this bookmaker in Southern California. And it had, like, you know, the story was about to hit. All of this was about to come to a head. So the Dodgers fired Mizuhara from, you know, I guess Ohtani and the Dodgers essentially collectively fired Ipe Mizuhara for his involvement in this illegal sports book. So it is important to note that California is one of the nine states where sports betting is still illegal. So whether or not you're talking about walking into a casino or you have your FanDuel app or you are going to a sports book, in which case it would be very illegal in California, but all of these things in California are illegal. If you open up your FanDuel app, since I have it, if I were to open up my FanDuel app and make a bet in California, it would ask me where I was. But if I were to make a bet in California, I would technically be violating federal law, I would be violating California state law, since it's still illegal there. So that's important to note. Just real quickly, the other states that so you have California, as mentioned, except for horse racing, they still abide by the PASPA in that regard. So horse racing is still legal in California, but betting on other sports is illegal. Alabama, it's illegal. Alaska, it's illegal. Georgia, it's illegal. Idaho, Minnesota, and Missouri, and Hawaii, and all gambling is illegal in Hawaii, where it was actually all gambling was outlawed prior to statehood even. So those are the nine states, just real quickly. Again, Alabama, Alaska, California, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Minnesota, and Missouri are the nine states in which it's illegal. Sports gambling is still illegal. So that's an important note here as we go on with the story. There's also where this really gets thorny and where there's a huge problem is that there are two conflicting stories that really kind of tilt. I don't want to say tilt blame necessarily. I don't think that's the right way to look at it, but it does sort of paint this story differently depending on which version of the story that you believe. And the problem is, again, two conflicting stories, but they were both confirmed by all parties, which obviously that just can't be, right? So the first version is Ipe told Ohtani about the debts and Ohtani covered his gambling losses, right? Like essentially Ohtani, who is, you know, between a contract and endorsements, makes like $60 million a year, $70 million a year. Obviously, plus he's going to get his massive deferred contract, a decade from now, regardless if he's playing with the Dodgers or not. So the first version of the story is that Ohtani essentially said, hey, you know, you're in trouble here. I got the money. I'll float you some money to cover your gambling losses, to cover those debts. That's the first version of the story. And then I don't even think it was a full day later. It might've been like within that day, the Ohtani's lawyers and representatives then sort of did an about face. After that was the original story, they did an about face and said that Ipe committed fraud, that he stole money from Ohtani's accounts to cover his losses. And both of these stories were confirmed again by Ipe Mizuhara and by Otani's lawyers and his other legal representatives. Obviously, these stories cannot be true at the same time. And this is obviously opened the door up to a lot of conspiracy theories when you have this kind of when you have this kind of news kind of bouncing back and forth, right? But there's like these things can't, like, they just can't be true at the same time. Especially when you consider, like, there's a lot here, right? So if Otani, again, keeping in mind that any kind of involvement with sports gambling in California is 100% completely illegal. The first story kind of makes it sound like, oh yeah, you know, this was a guy doing, you know, take out the names. This was a guy doing his friend a solid because he had the money for it and he wanted to bail him out of a bad situation. But then, you know, again, sports betting of any variety, and that even if you're just making payments to a bookie, you're not actually gambling or making bets. Just paying a bookie in California is illegal. So the second story feels like it's a pivot, like an oh shit pivot. Like, we can't go with that story because then we are admitting that Otani has done something illegal. So the way out of this then is to then blame Ipe for having stolen Otani's money to cover his losses, right? Like, and that doesn't like 100% make sense either. But I suppose it's possible, but it just doesn't make sense either because I can't imagine that. I don't know. I just actually here's why both versions of this story kind of just don't really make a ton of sense. And I'm just very curious to see what comes from. I don't think MLB. Well, there is an IRS investigation, a federal investigation. MLB is doing their own investigation, which I'm sure is going to find nothing, which we'll talk about here in a second. But just a lot of this doesn't add up correctly, because even though Ipe is more than an interpreter, I mean, he is a confidant, a friend. He helps, not that he like coaches Otani necessarily, but he's definitely one of the people that, that helps advise him on actual performance aspects. Again, like they've known each other for the better part of like almost a decade now. He is a very close-knit friend. He is in that very, very tiny circle of people that Otani keeps close. But I just still find it hard to believe that Ipe would have this much unrestricted access to Otani's money. That just, to me, just doesn't make sense. I don't know, it just doesn't really make sense. On the other hand, what really is interesting and doesn't make sense either is I can't imagine a bookmaker allowing someone, regardless of the fact that, you know, he was in the employ of Shohei Ohtani and the Dodgers, I can't imagine a bookmaker would allow someone like Ipe, who, you know, I'm sure this guy makes probably $600,000-$700,000 a year, but I can't imagine that he was allowing him to rack up debts that exceeded his yearly pay. Like, it doesn't make sense for a bookie to essentially extend a line of credit to someone who cannot pay any part of it. Like, that just doesn't make sense. It's not like an old gangster movie where he's gonna take Ipe out back and like break his legs or something for not being able to pay. He wants his fucking money. And breaking someone's leg doesn't give you money. It looks good in a movie or whatever, but like they want money. And again, like you wouldn't extend that sort of credit to someone who, you know, like if I was going to an illegal bookmaker, he wouldn't extend me a line of credit that easily exceeded my yearly take home pay. That just wouldn't make any sense. So there's a lot of holes in this, in any facet of the story. There's just a lot of holes that really allow for for all the conspiracy theorists to take up space and, you know, just begin blasting misinformation left and right. But I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it does feel like the pivot in such a short period of time were Otani's representatives trying to save face? Because I think there is a very bleak outcome here if things fall a certain way, right? Like, I think that there is something that could, there could be something very bad on the horizon if things don't, if things fall, let's just call it the worst possible outcome, right? If things fall a certain way, Otani could be suspended for life from baseball if this is some kind of cover-up situation and Ipe is actually some kind of willing or possibly unwilling fall guy. If that's what the truth reveals, then Otani would be suspended for life from baseball. You cannot bet on baseball. But there's also the commissioner has latitude to sort of include other illegalities when it comes to sports gambling. And because of the nature of gambling in California, sports gambling in California, which is again limited only to horse racing, if he indeed did have a direct hand in it, then Otani is guilty of a felony, and that would certainly fall under like the sort of latitude that Rob Manfred, the commissioner, would have in considering some sort of suspension, which again would almost think it would have to be a lifetime ban, essentially. That is the absolute worst possible outcome. I also think it's the least likely possible outcome. And I say this because I guess you never really know somebody unless you know somebody, and you especially don't know celebrities as well as you want to know them, right? You know, even if you're getting a look at their Instagram and their Twitter and, you know, whatever, they give good interviews and stuff and they seem like they're nice people and they give to charity and blah, 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 whatever. You don't really know. So I will begin with that caveat. However, here's what I definitely do know about Shohei Ohtani. He may be the most singularly focused person on their craft, on their sport, that, you know, maybe not has ever existed, but one of the people that is so singularly focused on making himself the best baseball player possible. It is so difficult to imagine him putting all that effort into, you know, being a great pitcher and being a great hitter and still having time or even the general interest to rack up $4.5 million worth of gambling debts. Like that just doesn't, to me, like, it just, knowing how much effort you have to put in to a professional sport and how certain players, you know, you've heard it probably recently. I can't remember Anthony Rendon kind of basically insinuated that like he doesn't like baseball that much, even though he's a professional baseball player and is getting paid a lot of money to do it. But that isn't that shocking. I mean, there's a lot of people, take away the fact that it's a sport, there's a lot of people who work jobs who are probably pretty good at those jobs that maybe they don't love those jobs, right? But Ohtani is clearly one of those people that loves playing baseball. It's just hard for me to imagine that he would have the time, the interest, to dive this far into gambling. We also know how closely guarded Ohtani keeps his personal life versus his professional life. So much so that, like, you know, when he was a free agent, there was speculation about, you know, about where, when there was speculation about where he would sign, there were, you know, people were, you know, like people, he was keeping the name of his dog a secret because he thought it might give away a hint as to where he was signing. You know, he's been married for like, I think he's been married for like several months now, but like, no one knew that there was a wedding and no one had ever even seen his wife until recently. She's like a former basketball player on the Japanese national team. You know, she kind of like made her debut, I guess, in Seoul for the opening games, for the opening weekend, or the, I guess, opening weekday games of the season. But like, no one had ever seen her. And it just, to me, it, someone who's that careful with their personal life and their professional image wouldn't be involved in something so openly, boldly stupid that could blow up their personal life and could blow up, you know, what they'd spent so long working for. It just doesn't ring like that's something that he would let happen simply because of how careful and calculated everything in his life is. This seems like one of those missteps that is not careful and not calculated, and I just can't imagine him being directly involved in it for that reason. That could be wishful thinking. I mean, I don't know, but I think the evidence says, you know, that to me, the evidence says that Ohtani was not necessarily directly involved in any kind of betting or gambling, but he clearly was directly involved in trying to bail his friend out. And that leaves the MLB and Rob Manfred with a pretty big conundrum, especially if there is, maybe there, you know, if it does turn out there's a little bit more here than we wouldn't, than the initial story is telling, it leaves MLB in this kind of bad spot. Do you suspend, possibly on a long-term or a permanent basis, the biggest star baseball has ever seen? Do you do that? Do you suspend Babe Ruth in his fucking prime because of something that he did potentially out of, you know, kindness? Do you suspend on a permanent or a very long-term basis the biggest fucking star in baseball? Do you, let's take this down a notch or two here. Do you even give him a slap on the wrist or a short suspension for doing something illegal, whether or not it was to save someone else's ass? I wonder where baseball, where the owners and Rob Manfred are all sitting on this. Certainly the players will always back their players. But I just wonder where they're sitting on this because of there's so much here that if they handle this incorrectly, they make themselves look very, very bad. And they make themselves look foolish, right? And I think even worse, they make themselves look incredibly hypocritical if they do handle this the wrong way. So I'm going to be very clear here before I dive into this, that I am not asking for baseball to do this. In fact, I think this would be terrible for baseball. However, if the MLB does anything short of suspending Ohtani for 30, 40, or 50 games, they're going to come across as looking incredibly inept and incredibly hypocritical because of the nature of where this is. We're not talking about someone jacking a needle into their ass for, you know, 20 extra feet in a home run. We are talking about the greatest black mark on baseball since it has started. Gambling is so closely tied with baseball in such a negative way that they have, the Black Sox. And if you, believe some people around the Black Sox scandals and people who knew, like Arnold Rothstein, the World Series was fixed for not just, 1908? I think 1909 World Series. All of them were fixed for a very long time. If you believe some people who would have been around Arnold Rothstein at that point in time, that all of them were fixed. Obviously, Pete Rose comes to mind, right? There is such a dark black mark that gambling has put on baseball. They've tried so hard to distance themselves from those things. Shoeless Joe Jackson and others, I think it's 1908 White Sox, now that I'm thinking about it. But, there are people that died 70, 80 years ago who are not allowed in the Hall of Fame or not allowed to be involved. Their names aren't even allowed to be involved in baseball because of their ties to gambling. Pete Rose is never, ever going to get into the Hall of Fame, which is a shame. And I don't feel personally for Pete Rose because he takes every opportunity to potentially to heal those wounds. He takes that opportunity to just rip at the wound even more. But the Baseball Hall of Fame should have the all-time hit leader, somewhere in its wings. Maybe after he dies, they might do something. But regardless, anyone that gets involved with gambling and baseball gets barred for life. Knowing absolutely full well that something illegal happened, and it had happened to involve gambling here, if they handle this the wrong way and nothing happens to Ohtani whatsoever, and again, I am not calling for this whatsoever, they will look like such a collection of hypocritical assholes that they will deserve whatever beating they get, both in social media and through the regular press. Whatever beating they get, MLB 100% will 100% will deserve. And just adding another layer to this, this hypocritical layer cake. MLB being hypersensitive to gambling, to people involved with the sport gambling, they're still more than happy to welcome the billions and billions of dollars that they can make via DraftKings and FanDuel, in-person sports books. They are more than happy to let that money flow in, which again makes them, again, they're going to look like hypocrites kind of no matter what they do. But I think that they're going to end up siding with their masters in this case, being, the online sports betting apps and, the fact that, sports gambling is now legal pretty much everywhere except for 9 states. They're going to side with that, which is again going to make them seem very hypocritical. I just had to bring this up because I saw this tweet last week, and it really hits it right on the head. It's hysterical, and it hits it right in the head. I don't remember who actually authored the original tweet, but it's one of my favorites that kind of sums up the situation. And here's how it goes. Welcome back to SportsCenter, presented by ESPN Bet. For more on the Ohtani situation, we go to our FanDuel MLB insider Jeff Passan at our DraftKings studios in Los Angeles, brought to you by Caesars Sportsbook. Jeff, how could something like this happen? And I think I'm not trying to assign blame necessarily here. Which was kind of like the overriding thing that I wanted to make sure that I didn't do, was just to sort of like position it as if gambling is bad necessarily. I just don't want to argue about the morality of it, right? Like, again, I place bets every year in multiple sports. Nothing major, usually just some futures bets, maybe a few week to week bets. Or, say game day bets, on football and stuff like that. It spices the games up. I have fun with it. But there's no doubt in my mind that there are not enough legitimate guardrails in place to keep people from losing their shirts on these gambling apps. The way that they're designed, the way that they're gamified, and then the only place you can go to help is like through a national hotline. There isn't enough in place, but I'm just not here to argue about that particular morality of it. It is what it is. It's legal pretty much everywhere. You're just going to have to deal with it. It's like smoking or drinking, right? There clearly isn't enough kind of in place to keep people from truly harming themselves in a very profound way with this kind of stuff. I also think that just flip this around, thinking about when it comes to the athlete side, who are in a very different position than us. I don't think there's enough clarity in place for how athletes are allowed to gamble. The NFL last year had a rash of players suspended for placing bets, like literally just physically where they couldn't be, which just seems kind of ludicrous. It kind of stems back to the idea that players, years ago would have like been meeting bookies at, at team facilities and things like that. And they kind of just advanced those rules for modern day, which doesn't make sense, because you could have someone betting legally on, on some basketball or something like that, but they're doing it at a team facility. So now it's illegal. It's just like a stupid little caveats that got guys suspended for like 4 and 5 games. Obviously, we had the Calvin Ridley situation. You know, his was this was entirely clear, and he should have known better. But Calvin Ridley was suspended for an entire year, but he gambled like something like $2,500 on some NFL playoff games. But the rule is, you cannot, and this is the rule for every single sport. You cannot gamble on your own sport at all. Once the integrity of your sport, if there's any chance that you might compromise the integrity of your sport, and it gets called into question, you are going to get hit with something major. So that's more of a Calvin Ridley didn't understand the rules as well as he should have understood them. But again, it just seems excessive to suspend someone for an entire season for gambling, something like $2,500 or something like that on FanDuel or the hell he was on. But again, rules are rules. And in fact, if you work at a casino in Las Vegas, you can feel free to eat there, hang out there, drink there. The one thing that you can't do, if you are an employee of a particular casino, you cannot gamble there. You can gamble at other casinos. You cannot gamble at your own. And that's the same thing that the sports have employed. That if you want to bet on hockey, baseball, football, March Madness, and you're a baseball player, totally fine. Just don't bet on baseball. That's the rule. Boy, just kind of gone down a couple different rabbit holes here. But I think this situation has the potential to show two things. As mentioned before, just how hypocritical is a league willing to get, is a league willing to be, to exempt its superstars? And also, exactly how are these gambling rules going to work if you are bigger than the game, right? Do the rules just simply not apply to you if you're Ohtani? I think we're going to find out, and I don't think, and again, I don't want anyone to be suspended, or especially someone like Ohtani, who is good for the game of baseball. You never want to see a sport without its biggest stars. And that's what would be happening if Ohtani gets suspended. But I think that the way this is going to break, there's going to be maybe a slap on the wrist of, a monetary fine of some variety. Maybe Ohtani has to sit out a week, 5 days, 5 games, something like that, and make a public statement. But that's it. I think we are going to see, I just think we're going to see that there are exceptions to this. If you're a rotational defensive tackle on an NFL team and you place a bet in the wrong place, you're going to get suspended for 4 games or 6 games or whatever it is. If you are the biggest star in your sport and you knowingly give money to an illegal bookmaker in a state where gambling is illegal, it's not going to matter. And I don't think I'm going to be wrong on this one, but we shall see how the situation unfolds. All right, that is it for today's episode. Went a little bit longer than I thought, but hey, no big deal. We are talking about modern, current topics, so we got to get in depth with them as best we can. But that is it. We will see you on Tuesday when we are talking about, of course, we got to talk about one of my favorites. We're going to be talking about Vladimir Putin. So we'll see you tomorrow.